In a series of lectures in 1966, Richard Dawkins first introduced the nascent idea of the selfish gene. He posited that genes are the basic units of natural selection. Successful genes are those whose numbers increase at the expense of unsuccessful alternatives. Everything else, cells, organisms, can be seen as those genes programming the organism to do things that will pass them on to the next generation. Survival machine was his name for organisms. Robots is another way he put it. Dawkins has written 12 books, his latest a memoir, An Appetite for Wonder. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. He was the Charles Simonyi Chair of Public Understanding of Science at Oxford. The Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science is dedicated to supporting science education and critical thinking. He's an atheist and a humanist. A 2013 poll named him one of the world's top thinkers. Dawkins is a much-honored public scientist, so to get his point across to the general public, he uses science, of course, as well as math, and sometimes poetry, like this one by the writer Aldous Huxley.
A million million spermatozoa, all of them alive. Out of their cataclysm, but one poor Noah dare hope to survive. And of that billion minus one might have chanced to be Shakespeare, another Newton, a new Donne. But the one was me. Shame to have ousted your betters thus, taking ark while the others remained outside. Better for all of us, froward homunculus, if you'd quietly died.
Why is that poem in this book about your life, An Appetite for Wonder, the making of a scientist?
Because I'm intrigued by the lucky chance of all of us being here. And the million, million spermatozoa is just one example. It doesn't apply just to your parents' generation, of course, but to your grandparents and your great-grandparents. And so the chance that we are not here is high, yet each of us is here as a matter of hindsight. Somebody has to be here, and it's us. We're very lucky. Don't let's waste our time.
I think that's so interesting that luck plays a part in the thinking of evolution.
Well, luck does play a part, but on the other hand, you can say that there's a certain amount of determinism as well. You can say that although each individual is extraordinarily lucky to be alive, you can predict that certain things will happen, that there will be carnivores and herbivores and flying animals and digging animals and climbing animals, so that there is a sort of predictability, even though there's luck for each individual.
You evolved this theory of the selfish gene using a lot of people. You acknowledge them either backwards, you realize people had been writing about this already, or forwards. People wrote with you and collaborated with you, talked to them. And you coined this phrase meme, but not the only one to use it. Is there a similarity between the way the thinking evolves and the way genes evolve?
There's a sort of similarity. Genes evolve by natural selection of random variation, and then there's non-random survival of certain genes rather than others. And you could say the same about ideas, that ideas arise not exactly at random, but you could say there's people kind of toss off ideas, and then the ones that are any good survive. So there's a kind of analogy to Darwinism there. It's not a very close analogy, I think, but it's one that has occurred to some people.
What's evolutionary Panglossianism?
Panglossianism, well, it comes from Voltaire, all is for the best and it's best of all possible worlds. And so it's the sort of naive view that because natural selection produces good results, birds fly, fish swim, etc., therefore somehow they're all perfect. And you don't have to ask the question, what actually is going on in natural selection? You just say something good will come, something good will happen. It's a naive way of avoiding thinking up the details.
Richard Dawkins is a scientist. He's author of The Selfish Gene, also The Magic of Reality. His latest is An Appetite for Wonder. It's a memoir charting his life up to the publication of The Selfish Gene. You said you were a Christian halfway through your teenage years. Why was that?
Because I was a child and I went to Christian schools. And if you go to Christian schools, the chances are you'll be Christian, at least for a while. It didn't last very long.
Darwinism gave you a different
thing. Yes, that's right. I mean, that's not the thing that makes everybody lose their religion, but in my case it was, yes.
Do you remember what the influence was, what you had read or what you were seeing?
Well, my father originally told me about Darwinism, and then I learned it at school as well. And I realized that the apparent order and elegance and beauty and illusion of design in the living world has a rational, naturalistic explanation. So it didn't need a supernatural explanation.
You said in a quote, I realized that Darwinism was a far superior explanation that pulled the rug out from under the argument of design, and that left me with nothing. With nothing?
No, not with nothing. Nothing of the original religious ideas that I'd had.
I see. Because that was a surprising quote.
Yes.
The idea of you being hanging there.
No, I wasn't left with nothing.
You were left with something more.
Yes.
Is that what put you on your path to science?
Well, in a way, yes. I suppose I technically already was on that path, but that certainly reinforced my walking along that path.
You know, you mentioned in the book that I think you made a comment that you went to boarding school, and that may sound brutal to some people. I think you used the phrase brutal.
I forget exactly the phrase I used. Well, it was tough. I mean, being away from home, there's a fairly sort of ruthless law of the jungle in boarding schools. Children do have a certain cruel streak, I think, which in most people goes away in adulthood.
Did it go away for you?
Yes, I think so.
Where does altruism fit into your thinking about evolution?
The whole of my first book, The Selfish Gene, is really about altruism. People sometimes think its title means it's about selfish individuals, but it's more about selfish genes programming individuals to be altruistic.
You had said, or somebody had said to you, you should have named it the immortal gene, and you agreed with that.
Yes, well...
Why is that better?
Well, in some ways it's better, partly because it's a more sort of romantic-sounding title. It's a sort of Carl Sagan-type title. But also, The Selfish Gene has been much read by title only and therefore much misunderstood as a statement that we're all selfish, or even worse, as an advocacy that we should be selfish, of which it's neither.
Well, I've been trying to think, and I know this is... I am now blending science into something else, but what's the reason that war appeals to so many individuals? I'm sure you've heard this question many times. And where does that work into the gene wanting to propagate itself?
Well, it's not easy to work it in. And I think there are certain other animals which do seem to go to war as a tribe. I mean, ants, for one thing. I've seen major wars between rival nests of leafcutter ants in Panama. But I think it's tribalism. I think it's loyalty to the in-group as against the out-group. But I would hesitate to give a naive, selfish gene explanation of war.
Where does tribalism come from?
Tribalism could come from the tendency to be loyal to your own kin group. Selfish genes do program altruism towards kin, and the obverse of that would be hostility towards non-kin.
Can I ask you something that was that I actually heard in a your exchange with John Stewart, and I wanted to hear a little more, so I was curious about it. So Stewart was asking you this question. You have this foundation, right? You have the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, and your mission is to support scientific education, critical thinking, evidence-based understanding of the natural world, in the quest to overcome religious fundamentalism, superstition, intolerance, and human suffering. That's the statement of your foundation.
Yes.
And Stewart asked this question, couldn't science and evidence-based thinking, I'm paraphrasing him, bring us to human suffering every bit as painfully as religion does?
Cause human suffering.
Cause? All right.
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, rational scientific thinking should actually be the best cure for human suffering. I mean, it's the best way of achieving anything you want to achieve. And if we want to achieve a cure for human suffering, science and reason is the best way to do it.
I mean, I think I was assuming that his argument was based on development of nuclear weapons.
Oh, well.
Development of...
Yes, because, of course, science is the best way. If you want to achieve anything, science is the best way to do it. If you want to achieve bad things, science is the best way to do it. The trick is to want to achieve good things and then pick the best way to do it, which is science.
The trick is to want to achieve good things. Where's that learning come from?
Well, I think that's obvious. I mean, you just... If you... Nobody wants to achieve bad things, or they shouldn't do. And we want to use science for the best possible reasons, and the worst possible reasons would be to use science to make terrible weapons of mass destruction. But if we want to achieve good things and achieve happiness, then science is also the best way to do it.
That's Richard Dawkins. His latest book is a memoir, An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist.